Welcome to today's program titled Information Security Policies and Data Breach Response. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are encouraged to consult a lawyer concerning your situation and specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purposes of avoiding tax penalty that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on all CLE attendance affirmation forms. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. Ladies and gentlemen, due to the high volume of participants, we will not be able to respond to questions during the webinar. All questions submitted will receive a response at the conclusion of the webinar. Our speaker's contact information has been included in the presentation, and you may feel free to contact them directly. At this time, I would like to turn the program over to our speakers.
Thank you, Donna. Hello, everyone. My name is Carla Grossenbacher, and on behalf of my co-presenter, John Tomaszewski, and the firm, we want to welcome you to this webinar on information security policies and data breach response plans. John and I are both members of Seyfarth's Global Privacy and Security team, and we want to thank you for joining us today. I'm going to start things off by giving a little background about why this issue is so important to the firm and our clients, and then I'll also talk about what we're going to cover today. We put together this webinar because we know this issue is of great interest to all of our clients. If you have even one employee, you or one of your vendors is very likely holding some of their personally identifiable information. It's no secret that data breaches and lawsuits over data breaches are on the rise. Almost every day, we get up to news of another high-profile data breach and another high-profile lawsuit, usually a class action, resulting from the breach. A lot of press around this issue has been devoted to talking about the ingenuity of certain hackers from certain other countries who are believed to be responsible for these breaches. But as many of you know, this is not the only way your PII can be breached. Certainly, hackers are becoming more creative and their attacks are becoming more frequent and publicized, but there are other more mundane and, in fact, more common ways to experience a data breach. Data breaches can occur in the good old-fashioned way. Someone leaves a laptop on the subway, someone leaves a mobile device in a restaurant, someone steals hard copy files containing personally identifiable information. In fact, we've seen that a significant number of breaches originate in a company's IT department. There can be coding errors or system vulnerabilities that lead to data accidentally being made publicly available. We also see things as simple as communications that are sent to an unintended recipient. And this is why most businesses have those footers on their email that say, if you are not the intended recipient, please destroy, please return, etc. So with this combination of hacker activity and human error or accidents, it's really, in our view, not a question of whether or not your company will suffer a data breach. It is really a question of when and what type. I've put on the slide some interesting results of a study conducted by the Ponemon Institute last year. The Ponemon Institute, if you're not familiar, conducts independent research in the areas of data privacy and information security. The first two statistics basically underscore the importance of vigilance, even if you think you have your cybersecurity house in order. Obviously, something's going wrong in the implementation of data security measures if 50% of those in the Ponemon study who experienced breaches said they should have been able to prevent it with technology they already had in place. So despite having systems in place, there can be errors and issues in the implementation and the execution. Or someone could just outsmart your security efforts. Data protection is an ongoing process of putting safeguards in place and constantly reviewing them for effectiveness. Now, the last statistic I have here about almost half the people in the study saying they found out about their breaches by accident made me think about a graphic chart I saw recently in a report that was put out this year by Verizon on data breaches. And it's a graphic chart that has two lines that contrast how often attackers are able to compromise an entity's information in a matter of days or less, with, on the other line, how the entity is able to detect the breach within the same time frame. So you can see these two lines together, and unfortunately, the proportion of breaches that are discovered within days is far below the number of breaches effectuated at the same time period. And even worse, if you look back at the prior reports where Verizon has done, the two lines have been diverging over the last decade, which means there's a growing, what they call in the report, detection deficit between the attackers hacking the information and the company who's being hacked finding out about it. It's no surprise to anyone that with reported and publicized data breaches being on the rise, that data breach lawsuits are also on the rise. These lawsuits, of course, are just one cost of a data breach. I've listed the others. The ripple effects on revenue and reputation cannot be denied. They've been proven time and again. Until recently, many people, I think, viewed data breach litigation as confined to the retail and healthcare space. And no question, there are a number of high-profile cases concerning claims by individuals and financial institutions regarding the compromise of customer credit card information and suits concerning breach of medical information provided to insurers. However, one of the largest class actions in recent memory was brought on behalf of employees, former employees, and applicants of the federal government just a few months ago. As most of you know, OPM experienced a massive data breach this year, and is being sued in various parts of the country on behalf of a putative class of 18 million people. And interestingly, it's not just OPM, the employer, being sued in the putative class action, but also the third-party vendor, Keypoint, that stored the PII collected by OPM throughout the employment application and background check process. Now, in these cases brought concerning a data breach, negligence is the most frequent claim brought, along with various state law claims based on state laws regarding data breach notification, disposal of PII, et cetera. Given the prevalence of negligence claims, I think you'll see that the underlying theme for our discussion today about information security policies and data breach response plans is designed to meet that reasonable care requirement. What are the best practices in these areas that will lead you to a position where a judge or a jury will determine that you have acted reasonably in addition to complying with applicable law? So given the background I've just provided, it should be fairly clear why you need an information security policy and a data breach response plan. A good information security policy will protect your data and should prevent breaches, although nothing is foolproof, and there's no one-size-fits-all when it comes to information security programs or incident response plans, but there are best practices and key components for both of these, which we're going to discuss today. Also, from a compliance perspective, a good information security policy is needed because there is an emerging trend, as you'll see in the state breach notification laws, to have a substantive requirement about information security. Some states require that you have reasonable safeguards in place to protect the personally identifiable information in your possession. There are also federal laws that require such measures regarding specific types of information, and we're going to talk about those. So if you don't have a good program in place, you might be violating one of these laws that says you need to have reasonable safeguards in place, and you might also be deemed to be negligent. Your information security policy will also, I promise you, be Exhibit A if you are ever sued over a data breach, because this is what's going to allow you to show that you took reasonable precautions to safeguard your data and comply with the law. And the same is true of a data breach response plan. A good plan will be your guidepost in actually remediating the breach. And right there with your information security policy, your data breach response plan is going to be Exhibit B if you are ever sued over a data breach, to show that you planned for and took reasonable steps after the breach. And there are also specific state law requirements that we'll discuss in detail today regarding notification in the event of a breach. So a good data breach response plan is important from a compliance perspective. Also, we'll discuss in more detail, many state laws have safe harbors in place for companies that have their own notification procedures. In essence, these safe harbors provide that under certain circumstances, your company will be deemed to have complied with state notification procedures if it has followed its own procedures. So what we're going to cover today is, first, we're going to talk about the legal framework at the international, federal, state level that provides the basis for what we're going to discuss in our best practices and that underpins information security policies and data breach response plans, so you can see at least in part how we've developed our best practices and why they are what they are. John is then going to discuss the key elements of a state-of-the-art information security policy. I will then review the key elements of a data breach response plan and also best practices for language with your third-party vendors who maintain personally identifiable information for you. So we will begin now with a discussion of the legal framework, and I'm going to turn it over to John to talk about federal and international laws regarding information security and breach notification.
Thanks, Carla. So we've had a lot of history looking at breach notification statutes, and there's been a lot of discussion in the political sphere around whether or not there needs to be a federal law or whether or not the state laws can be maintained. And as of right now, there isn't an omnibus federal breach notification requirement, but in most of the regulated industries, for example, healthcare and financial services, there are going to be breach notification requirements. What a lot of people forget about also is that if you're a publicly traded company, there may be requirements to provide breach notification under the SEC rules. If you've got a material impact or a material event that occurs based on a breach, which is something that's reportable in your financial reporting, then you're going to need to comply with the SEC rules around this as well. So when you're looking at the landscape of looking at a breach notification response plan, it may not necessarily be as simple as you think it is, because there may be other requirements that exist outside of just state requirements. Interestingly enough, the U.S. leads the world, if you will, in information security, breach notification, and substantive security requirements. A number of countries are starting to develop security laws, breach notification laws, and along with them, they're taking a lot of cues from what's going on in the U.S. at the state level. South Korea, for example, has a fairly recent information security and breach notification set of requirements that are very stringent. Japan just passed an amendment to its Personal Information Protection Act in September of this year. Mexico, Philippines, South Africa, these are all countries that are starting to develop information security and breach notification requirements within their regulatory regimes. And for anybody who's following what's going on in Europe, the new EU regulation is going to impact 28 countries all at once. So this is no longer going to be an issue where you have to worry about 47 different states. It's now an issue where you're going to have to deal with 50 or 60 different countries along with the 47 different states. So being able to develop a set of policies and a set of procedures that are effective in managing this so that you have a compliance posture that gets you where you need to be with regard to all of these different requirements starts to become a critical path for a corporate governance structure.
So now we turn to the question of the state laws that cover data breach notification in the United States. Given that there's no comprehensive federal legislation on this issue, for compliance purposes, companies must look to state law. Now, the overview I'm about to provide you is intended to give you an idea of what issues are addressed in the state laws, but I am not going to provide a detailed listing of all the requirements of 47 different states plus all the territories. That would be far too much level of detail for many of the people on the phone who are only in certain states. But I want to give you an idea of the types of things that are addressed in these state data breach notification laws and what the common themes are. The issue of which state's law applies can be an interesting one. It's not just about where you, the company, are located, which is often how we figure out things like what employment laws apply or what law governs the contracts we enter into. When you're looking at state data breach notification laws, it's about where you do business because this is where your customers and your employee live. These state statutes are written to protect the citizens of that particular state. So if you compromise the PII of one of those citizens, that state law is in play. So when getting ready to sit down, for example, and draft your data breach response plan, which in large part is going to be dictated by what these state laws provide, you need to, as best you can, figure out what state laws would apply if the PII you maintain or have a third party maintain for you is compromised. Some of these states also, as we're going to discuss, have substantive information security provisions. And others require certain language and vendor contracts in addition to the procedures you have to follow in the event of a breach. So you want to know what those substantive requirements are and comply with them in advance of any breach. Because once the breach occurs, things will be happening very rapidly. It's going to be too late to be sitting down and saying, I wonder which laws apply. You want to try to figure that out as best you can in advance, because you want to anticipate and do some of the legwork on the compliance points in advance of the breach. So each of these state data breach notification laws has what I will call a trigger, meaning if X happens, then you need to comply with the law. Typically, and each law states it a little differently, and I'm probably going to sound like a broken record today because you're going to hear a lot of that. Typically, but each state says it a little differently, and that's one of the big problems with having 47 different state laws govern the issue. But typically, the trigger involves unauthorized access or taking of PII where the PII is neither encrypted nor redacted or otherwise rendered unusable. And the majority of states also require a certain risk of harm threshold. So obviously one key point in your information security program, and John will speak more about this, is to encrypt or redact your personally identifiable information such that if your PII is compromised, you will not trigger the requirements of one of these laws. Some of the states have specific definitions of what it means to be encrypted or redacted, so you'll want to review your methodology for encryption or redaction against any state law that you believe applies to the PII you hold. Also, as I mentioned, a number of state laws have risk of harm thresholds, meaning the state law requirements are not triggered even if a breach of PII occurs, if it can be said that the unauthorized access or acquisition of the PII will not likely subject someone to identity theft or present a substantial risk of harm. And I'm paraphrasing a bit here because, again, they all state it a little bit differently. But this is a very dicey area, in my opinion, because you are being invited in the first instance to make this determination when you experience a breach. And you need to be really careful about determining that you, your circumstance, does not meet the risk of harm threshold, and therefore you do not need to comply with the breach notification statute, because you've determined there is no, whatever the verbiage in the particular statute is, substantial risk of harm, substantial risk of misuse. And in recent months, this type of determination becomes even more risky after the Seventh Circuit decision in Rahimas versus Neiman Marcus, where the court essentially said, in finding that there was standing in the case, that every breach presents a risk of harm. Because as the Seventh Circuit wrote in the opinion, why else would someone hack into your system or steal your PII unless they intended to do some harm, right? So this is the risk of harm threshold, you got to be very careful if you're going to make that determination. So I mentioned on the previous slide that one of the triggers for state law application is whether or not personally identifiable information was compromised. And states, as you can expect, define this a little differently. But what I've put on the slide here is the most common formulation of what personally identifiable information is. So you'll see this in the bulk of states, although again, you have some people in various state legislatures who've expanded the definitions of PII to include items like date of birth information, biometric data, mother's maiden name, passport number, even financial account number separate from the required codes. And then some states have these broad catch-alls that say any information that could allow someone to steal your identity, basically, to kind of cover themselves in case they haven't thought of everything. You may have heard about the Illinois bill that was recently vetoed by Governor Rauner. The bill proposed to expand the definition of personally identifiable information under the Illinois law to include consumer marketing information and geolocation data. And in vetoing the bill, the governor said it goes too far, and that this expansion of the definition of PII was unwarranted because the geolocation data and the consumer marketing information did not pose the same risk of identity theft as the information I have up here on the slide. So that was, you know, an interesting putting the brakes on what you're going to see is a lot of activity at the state legislative level. Now, once state law is triggered, these data breach notification statutes provide for notice. Written hard copy notice is going to be sufficient in any state you're in. So if you're looking for a default, that's your default. In some instances, what they call substitute notice is allowed. And again, every state says it a little differently, but typically substitute notice is allowed if either the number of people who must be notified or the cost of notification meets a certain threshold limit set in the statute. Another scenario is when the notifying entity does not have adequate contact information to contact the affected individuals. And the method for substitution notice, which will be in the individual statute, is usually, you have a few options: notification by email, publication to media outlets, or conspicuous notice on the notifying entity's website, or some kind of combination of these. As for timing of the notice, though the verbiage can be a little different, essentially it is as soon as possible and without unreasonable delay. It's always both, as soon as possible and without unreasonable delay. A new trend that we're seeing is to put an outside numerical limit on this. So you have a handful of states that'll either say 90 days or 45 days. This was also part of the failed Illinois bill. It had a 30-day business requirement, and one of the things Governor Rauner said in his amendatory veto, where he basically says, here's what I think you should change, is, you know, why do you have to be different from everybody else? Why do you have to be 30 business days when we already have people saying 45 days? So he suggested that it was six of one, half dozen of another, to just go to 45. So I've given you here on this slide, again, the typical examples of who must be notified. And again, it's going to differ from state to state, just different enough to make compliance complicated, especially if you're an entity that holds PII for people across the country. But essentially, under the statutes, notification breaks down into two types. Notice to the affected individual or owner of the PII, and then notice to other entities such as government entities or consumer reporting agencies. Many states require notice to the state attorney general, who in many states is responsible for enforcement of the data breach notification statutes. Typically, the statutes you'll see will make a distinction between the entity that owns the PII and the entity that stores another entity's PII for it, so kind of like the OPM key point distinction. Typically, if an entity maintains PII for the owner of the PII under these statutes, the entity that's maintaining the PII for someone else has to notify that someone else, and then it is the actual owners of the PII who have to notify the affected individuals. That is the most common scenario under these statutes. Some laws have certain content requirements for the notice. Many laws don't say anything at all about what you have to put in the notice to affected individuals under the statutes. Those that do, again, I've put on the slide the most typical of the requirements. And this can be, you know, very complicated from a compliance perspective if you are in a situation where you have to comply with several state laws. Often the notifying entity will have to issue more than one notice in order to comply with all of the applicable state laws. Typically, you can do one notice that covers the requirements of a number of laws. But there are some states that are so specific, you just do a special notice for that state. So, for example, Massachusetts requires that a notifying entity provide specific details on how to put a security freeze in place with the three nationwide consumer reporting agencies. So maybe you don't want to do that in every notice, so you do a special Massachusetts notice. Like I said, what I've listed on the slide is fairly typical in terms of the content of the notice for those states that require it. Usually, you know, there's a description of the nature of the incident, again, except in Massachusetts, which prohibits the notifying entity from describing the nature of the incident, the date of the breach, the specific type of PII affected, contact information for various entities, the notifying entity itself, the National Consumer Reporting Agencies, the FTC, or even the State Attorney General's Office. And finally, some states require that the notifying entity advise the affected individuals to be vigilant and give them tips on how to protect themselves from identity theft and fraud. Now, there is a provision that I alluded to earlier that appears in almost a third of the statutes in the states that provide what I call a safe harbor. It's not labeled as such, but that's how I refer to it. It's stated very similarly across the states, like they've all been copying from each other, and provides essentially that if the notifying entity has its own procedures for notification as part of an information security program, and that notice is consistent with the timing requirements in the statute, the notifying entity's compliance with its own procedure will be deemed compliance with the notification provisions of the statute. Now, to our knowledge, the safe harbor has not been tested in any published case, but you at least want to have this argument open to you in litigation. So you want to have, you know, your own data breach response plan and notification procedure that you can follow. With regard to the other provisions that I allude to on the slide, a handful of states like California, Maryland, Nevada require that businesses who have third-party vendors maintain PII for them, put certain language in their contracts with these vendors that require the vendor to take reasonable steps to safeguard the PII the vendor stores for them. Another handful of state laws contain substantive information security requirements that state a company must take reasonable steps to safeguard PII. They all state it a little differently, but it's really a reasonableness requirement. So essentially building in that negligence standard, which is what's applied in most of the data breach litigation. And these substantive requirements, of course, you want to know about in advance, right? Because once the breach happens, it's too late to go back in and get your vendor contract and put the language in that the statute is requiring. Most statutes put enforcement in the hands of the State Attorney General's Office. As some of you may recall, the State Attorney Generals a few months ago banded together and wrote a letter to Congress asking them not to pass a federal breach notification statute because they feel that their enforcement of these types of statutes is very critical to protecting the citizens of their states. A small minority of states expressly provide a private right of action for their breach notification statutes. This, of course, does not stop plaintiff's lawyers, as we've seen in litigation, from trying to argue that a private right of action exists in statutes that do not expressly provide for one. To the plaintiff's bar, the rule appears to be, if it doesn't say there is no private right of action, then there must be a private right of action. However, one way or another, these statutes provide for consequences in the event a business violates them. They have teeth, whether it's penalties imposed by the Attorney General or damages for a lawsuit. And failure to comply with these statutes can also have more far-reaching implications. It's not just about the straight-up enforcement issues. As I mentioned before, negligence is the most common claim in data breach litigation. So certainly, a plaintiff's lawyer will argue that failure to comply with state breach notification statutes is evidence of negligence. In other words, a failure to exercise reasonable care. So this would also apply to those substantive requirements that I mentioned on the prior slides. If your safeguards are not adequate, you could also be found to be negligent in addition to being in violation of the statutes that have this reasonable requirement for substantive information security. And as alluded to in the subtitle for this program, which is if you revised your policies in June, they're probably obsolete, there's been a huge amount of legislative activity at the state level on the issue of breach notification. With breaches becoming more common and getting more publicity, states have been reviewing how well their laws actually protect the residents of their respective states in the event of a breach. I've given you a sample on the slide of the various types of changes that have been made recently to give you an idea of the nature and level of activity. We're likely to see more substantive revisions like the one in Rhode Island that I lead the slide with. This risk-based information security program requirement that Rhode Island has put in place really mirrors the arguments being made by plaintiffs in data breach litigation. For example, the plaintiffs in the OPM case are saying, hey, OPM, we realize you may have had some security measures in place, and good for you. I guess you thought they were reasonable. But what you should have known was that our data, and this is right in the complaint, our data was a particularly attractive target to hackers. KeyPoint was holding information from people who had gone through top secret security clearances for the federal government. And the OPM plaintiffs are arguing that exercising reasonable care with respect to their information looks different from exercising reasonable care with respect to the average employee applicant's information. They're essentially arguing that there should have been a risk-based information security program. Of course, in OPM, where employees are suing, they can also argue that there's a heightened duty of care due to the employee-employer relationship. Unlike someone shopping at a retailer, an employee often has no choice but to entrust their PII to the employer if they want to have a job, get paid, sign up for benefits, things like that. Connecticut, the second bullet I have on here, became the second state after California to require credit monitoring to be provided as part of their data breach notification statute. We are likely to see more of this as well. And then you have states adding the content requirements for notices because many don't have this, and expanding the definition of PII is also becoming more common. So that's why we say if you revise your policies and plans in June, they're likely obsolete because all of these changes that I have on this slide came down or took effect since that time. So now I'm going to turn things back over to John to talk about the key elements of an information security policy.
Thanks, Carla. Before we get to the best practices of how to actually comply with some of these requirements, I'm going to give the participation code. So the participation code for today's CLE is SS, as in Seyfarth Shaw, 4180. That's SS. 4180. Now, looking at how to actually build a information security policy framework in terms of best practices so that you don't have to update them every time the law changes is really an exercise in looking at trends that we've seen already in the legislative direction. The first one obviously is the control framework you're looking at needs to be risk-based. As we saw with Rhode Island, and as we're seeing with a number of other pieces of litigation, that, and also in the regulated industries, for example, HIPAA and Gramm-Leach-Bliley, not all data is the same. And so, and also not all data environments are the same. So when you're looking at building your information security framework, you need to embed risk-based analyses within the control framework. Not all information requires the same level of control. So understanding what information you have, how it's being used, where it moves to is going to be critical in being able to develop a, quote, reasonable, unquote, information security posture. The other thing to take into consideration is when you're looking at scope, information that was once not identifiable when confined with other identifiable information can become personally identifiable information. So the scope of your policy and the scope of your controls need to include not just PII, but also information that can become PII. It's also not just the data center. We're seeing and have seen in the past both regulatory action from the FTC as well as litigation with regard to inappropriate controls around paper documents, like banks throwing away documentation that are in paper files and some, without shredding them. And also, remember, you're not just looking at your customer and your employee data. You're also needing to look at your vendor controls. And we'll talk about this a little more with regard to the contracts, but you need to have also information security controls within your internal posture that define how your vendor can actually access your system and access your data. So what are some of the key elements? What are some of the things that need to be in an information security policy in terms of best practices? The first one is access. How do you have access? How do you control people who can come into your environment, who can pull data, who can manipulate data, and who can leave with data? So you need to be able to restrict access to your environment. Some of this is going to be access control with regard to your networks. Some of it's going to be access control with regard to physical location, so whether or not somebody can actually walk into your office and look at files. Some of this is going to be access control with regard to differing devices that are floating around. We've seen a proliferation of folks that are using bring your own device as a way to improve productivity for their employees. That's fine, but in instances, those personally owned devices aren't managed to the same level of security as corporate owned devices. So being able to understand what types of devices are being attached and accessing your environment in terms of being able to control who has access to your environment and who doesn't. These access control tools need to be robust. It's not good enough just to have a password if you're allowing the password to be 12345 or 1234. It's not good enough to have a firewall in place unless your firewall configuration actually blocks traffic. Some of this is challenging because in order to actually be productive, you need to have the right kind of firewall rules in place so that you can actually get out to the internet or get out to your clients or have your customers access your websites. So there's going to be a balance in terms of access control and encryption and these other types of security controls that allow for both functionality but also allow for sufficient security that you're actually complying with a reasonableness standard and your risk-based approach. Fundamentally, who do you trust to let into your environment? Why is it allowed to have somebody with their own cell phone or their own computer or even a vendor coming in with their own network being able to access your data? These are important things to consider when you're looking at what goes into your information security posture. Hold on. Okay, sorry. The next question is storage. You know, a lot of the breaches we're seeing are information being stored on laptops or USB drives that get lost. So how do you control that? People are going to continually lose devices, especially when they're small and highly portable. That's just a fact of life. One of the ways that you control that is make sure that you have personally identifiable information, especially sensitive personally identifiable information, encrypted anytime it is not within your environment. In addition, depending on the risk associated with the environment, if you have a lot of third-party actors that can access your environment, for example, a website, an e-commerce website, having data encrypted at rest, even within your environment, is also going to be important, because the more actors you have access your environment, the less control you have. And as a consequence, the more alternatives you need to implement to ensure that you can actually properly secure the data that's in there. Same problem with archiving. So you've got data that's no longer within your environment. It's going to Iron Mountain, or it's going to a storage as a service storage provider, or potentially even not archived, but in real time you're using a cloud-based service provider. Make sure that you understand the security around your archive. And then finally, media management. This is something that a lot of people forget about, because they think, oh, well, it's all of the hard drives that contain my personally identifiable information are in a data center that's physically secured and nobody can get to it. Well, what happens when those drives fail? Very likely, the drive vendor is going to come in, pick up the drive, and leave with it. What happens to those old disks? We've seen story after story where somebody has bought refurbished or repurposed hardware on eBay that actually contains personally identifiable information. This is a real challenge. Transmission controls is another way of making sure that you have reasonable security. So you have restricted access to your environment. You have storage controls within your environment. But the environment doesn't operate within a vacuum. And as a consequence, how do you get data into and out of those environments? How do you deal with trusted networks and devices versus untrusted networks and devices? Data loss prevention becomes important. And how you actually set up your differing network fabric also becomes very important, because some networks are going to be more trusted than other networks, even within your own network environment. A lot of the transmission controls are the things that you traditionally see with regard to information security. You know, do you have the right kind of firewalls? Do you have the right kind of data loss prevention strategies? These are things that exist primarily in the IT space. Similarly, in terms of storage controls, these are things that exist within the IT space. But even there, with the media management issue, you're starting to see process controls that need to be in place. The key element that needs to come out of this is the idea that your information security posture is not just with the IT department. It's also with the business, and it's also with the employees. Threat controls is becoming more and more of a critical path concern, and this is coming out of the Verizon threat report, the 2015 data breach investigation report that Verizon put out just recently. Has a very interesting statistic in it, and that's 97% of all the hacks that occur come from about 10 common vulnerabilities. Of those 10 common vulnerabilities, 99% of them have been identified and patches have been released for about a year. So this is not zero-day attacks. These are common vulnerabilities that have been out for at least a year, and in many instances, some of them are in upwards of 4 to 10 years old. So when you're looking at threats, make sure that your threat controls include not just the traditional intrusion detection, network penetration testing, code reviews, but also an understanding of how to do patch management. Because if you don't have up-to-date antivirus or any malware software, the antivirus and any malware software you do have isn't going to be very effective. So this is not just technological, it's also process. How do you make sure that you have up-to-date patches on your network and on your AV, and you have up-to-date patches on all of your code that you deploy as well? This is going to be really critical when you start looking at deploying applications, your own business's applications, because making sure that all your own code is patched is also going to be critical to make sure that nobody can take advantage of vulnerabilities that are inherent in your code. Finally, you have to have training. All of the policies in place are not going to be effective unless people know that they're out there and know what their responsibilities are. This needs to be both general as well as job specific. Different people have access to different data for different reasons, and they need to understand, based specifically on why they have access to data, what their obligations are around that. Plus, it's pretty typical that people retain training when it's geared toward their own personal job function. So the effectiveness of your training is also going to be an element of why it needs to be job specific. Phishing and social engineering are not necessarily direct attacks against the network, they're direct attacks against the people. And so understanding that your people are also a component of your network security is something that is definitely a best practice. Make sure that you include it within your information security posture. Then finally, audit. Make sure that once you've deployed all of these policies and all of these techniques, that they're actually in place and are working. This will also allow you to catch weaknesses within your environment before a hacker catches the weakness within your environment. Some folks are actually engaging in red teams, which are internal penetration testers that hack internally the systems to make sure that the company finds it before anybody on the outside finds it. Then some non-standard components that a lot of folks forget about. Quality assurance. Making sure that your code actually works the way it's supposed to is not just a security function, it's also a quality function. We've talked about vendor management. I'll let Carla talk about that shortly. But also making sure that when you're acquiring new technology, there's a security review on this. The Heartbleed vulnerability is a good example of how technology acquisition not being properly vetted is going to be something that you need to concern yourself with when you're deploying new tech. Finally, records management. It's not just about destruction. It's about secure destruction and secure archiving. And with that, I will turn it back over to Carla.
Thanks, John. So I'm going to go through key elements and best practices of a data breach response plan, which will complement your information security policy. So the first thing you need to do when developing a data breach response plan is identify the members of the data breach response team. The team will ideally include people from the following areas. One, someone from legal to advise on compliance issues and identify litigation risk. Two, your chief privacy officer if you have one. Three, a representative from information technology, your CTO, your CIO, whoever's over that function. Someone also from corporate security, as physical security can also be an issue in some breaches. A human resources representative. The head of the business unit affected by the breach. Someone from your internal audit function or compliance team. And a public relations specialist. Now, if you're a smaller company, you may not have all these functional areas, and one person may be wearing a number of these hats, but these are the stakeholders. These are the areas that all have a role to play in data breach response. And some of these people may not be internal to your organization, right? So you could use outside legal, you could use an outside PR firm. Now, the first task of the team is to verify that the data breach occurred and that it triggered applicable state law, and then conduct an investigation. The investigation should be conducted under the attorney-client privilege at the direction of in-house or outside counsel, as you will certainly be developing information that could be used against you later in a lawsuit. So you want it to be, at least in the first instance, cloaked in privilege. As part of your investigation in the wake of a data breach, there's a lot of data to be collected. Your IT folks are going to play a critical role here, but it's not uncommon to also engage a forensics professional, depending on the nature of the breach. The information you should collect is how and when the breach was discovered. What type of breach was it? Were systems compromised? Was hardware lost? And what was the method of intrusion? You should determine the duration of the breach as best you can and figure out what information was put at risk and whether or not that data was encrypted or redacted, because that's going to be important in determining whether state breach notification laws are triggered. Should determine whether the data was deleted, modified, viewed, whatever it was. And then lastly, determine what individuals were affected by the compromise of the PII. And once you have the basic facts about the breach, you need to assess the legal risk. So first you need to determine what laws are in play, federal or state, And in terms of state law, this is why you need to know what individuals were affected so you can determine what law applies. And under the applicable state laws, as we discussed, if unencrypted PII was compromised, is there a risk of harm sufficient to satisfy any applicable risk of harm threshold? And then you need to determine if notification is required. You then want to see if you have any insurance that applies to the loss, and if so, now would be the time to notify the carrier about the breach. If a third party is involved, pull the contract and determine if there's an indemnification obligation, and look at what provisions apply in the event of a breach. And you should assess the risk of litigation, regulatory action. And finally, if the breach was caused by employee error or malfeasance, determine what, if any, disciplinary action is going to be taken against that individual. So if you determine that notification is required under a state or federal statute, then you need to ensure that notice is made in a timely and legally compliant manner. So that's two things, sufficiently quickly and containing the proper content. You need to determine who needs to be notified. As I mentioned before, it's not just the affected individuals and owners of the PII. It can also be governmental entities. Once you determine who needs to be notified, you can consider whether, based on size of the breach, you were going to handle the notification internally or retain a vendor service to do it. It depends on the size, but you may want an outside party to print and mail the notifications or even operate a call center. As I said before, hard copy written notice is always going to be fine, but you should determine if you meet any of the thresholds in a particular state statute for substitute notice. And then once you determine the method of notice, you draft your template notice or notices, depending on how many state statutes are in play that have content requirements. To keep yourself organized, I can't emphasize enough to keep a database regarding notification. Not only is it going to keep you organized, it's going to demonstrate your compliance. And in this database, and it can just be an Excel sheet, nothing fancy, you list the people and entities to whom you've provided notice, how you provided notice, and when you provided notice. And be sure to record the address you used or the contact information you used in case there's an issue with the accuracy of the information. Now, in addition to a notification plan, you also need a communication plan that lives outside of the notification process. The notification plan is more the realm of the lawyers. The communication plan is more the realm of public relations. And when I say internal communications, I'm referring to communications with your employees or your board of directors, your business partners. And external communications, I'm referring to communications with the media, law enforcement, and affected individuals, as the case may be. In my opinion, external and internal communications about the breach should be pretty similar, because in this day and age, you can expect that any communication regarding the breach that you provide to your employees, for example, can and will be sent outside the organization. Emails can be forwarded, people post things on social media, information is hard to contain in that manner. Now, in developing the communications, there's always a tension between, on the one hand, being transparent and responsive in the wake of the breach, and on the other hand, protecting the organization's reputation and managing legal risk. You need to also make sure that the communications are as accurate as possible, but when writing them, always keeping in the back of your mind that if you don't know all the facts surrounding the breach, that there are unknowns and facts are subject to change. So if you're in that situation, definitive statements may not be the order of the day. You're just giving the information as you have it and know it. Some statutes require contact information to be in the notices to affected individuals, so they have someone to call for information. And I've listed on the slide some of the ones that are required depending on the state statute in play. But even if not required, as a matter of customer relations or risk management, you should consider including this type of information to give affected individuals an avenue to ask questions and get information. And you could use some of these examples that I have on the slide. Offering remediation services is generally optional unless you're in California or Connecticut, where they have the credit monitoring services for a 12-month period that is required. But even if not required by law, similar to providing contact information for questions, offering remediation services can go a long way toward generating consumer goodwill in the wake of a breach, or employee goodwill. It can also affect outcomes in litigation by reducing potential damages in the event of litigation, or positively influencing the jury's perception of the organization, right? Good guys offer these services because they care about the employees or their customers. And I've listed on the slide some typical remediation services that can be offered. Now, recently, some people, in the wake of the Seventh Circuit's opinion in the Neiman Marcus case, have suggested that offering remediation services can have an adverse effect on litigation. And that's because in the Neiman Marcus case, the Seventh Circuit, in determining whether there was an imminent threat of harm sufficient to confer standing, the court stated that the fact that Neiman Marcus had offered remediation services to affected individuals showed that even Neiman Marcus thought there was risk of harm that was imminent, because why else would they provide remediation services? Now, my personal opinion that this is just one small factor, one data point in the decision to offer remediation services. In Neiman Marcus, recall that the Seventh Circuit was considering this information not to prove the ultimate issue of negligence. It was to determine the issue of standing. And while admissibility of evidence is up to whatever judge is on the case, there's a very good argument that offering remediation services is likely inadmissible for the purposes of showing negligence. So perhaps you don't want to let the tail wag the dog in that instance. After investigating the breach and making the required notifications, you should take the time to step back, analyze the breach, analyze your response to the breach. For example, thought should be given to what could have been done to prevent the breach, if anything, if systems failed or people made errors, determine how this can be avoided in the future. Perhaps make a plan to provide training to personnel on information security. Review your IT systems and physical security in your locations. In addition to analyzing the breach, you should analyze your response as well. What grade would you give yourself on your response? What could have been done differently or better? And then update your data breach response plan accordingly, because data security is an evolving process which we learn over and over and over again. Technology changes, and our protocol and incident response measures have to evolve with them. I'm going to spend the last few minutes talking about considerations for dealing with third-party vendors. Your contracts with vendors who store PII for you should require the vendors to take reasonable steps to protect the PII you share for them. That's the basic concept. And as I mentioned before, a handful of states like California, Maryland, and a few others have specific requirements about what goes in to such third-party contracts. And there are also requirements under HIPAA and Gramm-Leach-Bliley. You also need to perform due diligence in selecting the vendors who maintain your PII to determine if they're capable of protecting your PII. One of the allegations in the OPM litigation is that OPM was unaware that KeyPoint, its vendor for people who went through top secret security clearances, had suffered a number of data breaches in the past. And recalling that negligence is a prevalent claim in data breach litigation, you're going to want to make sure you're exercising reasonable care in the vendor selection process. You also need to maintain oversight of the vendor during the contractual relationship and require in the contract that you can periodically review their privacy and data security measures during the course of the contract, not just during the selection process. And this can be done by requiring audit rights in the contract, or you can require that the vendor make certain disclosures to you during the course of the contract to keep you informed about their privacy and data security practices and whether there have been any incidents. If you have vendor personnel on site at your locations, make sure they're complying with your information security policies and physical security policies. Also, knowing that encryption and redaction is a key part of not triggering data breach notification statutes, make sure you and your vendor are on the same page with regard to the level of encryption and redaction being used on the PII that the vendor stores for you. You want to be clear also about the protocols regarding transfer of the PII from you to your vendor to make sure that that process is also secure. And then finally, in the contract, make sure that your respective obligations in the event of a breach are clear and appropriate indemnification provisions are put in place. So that concludes the substantive portion of the webinar, and I'm now going to turn it back over to Donna, our moderator.
Thank you very much. I just want to point out that the speaker's information has been included I understand that we will not be doing question and answer session during the webinar today, but we wanted to make sure that all parties were able to contact the speakers in the event that you would like to ask questions directly of either of our speakers. This concludes today's webinar, and thank you for attending.